Hey, it's Francis Lamb, host of The Splendid Table. Every week on our show, we talk about food and cooking and the meanings of food and cooking. We talk with the most interesting people in food about their techniques, their culture, and everything in between. Whether it's about how fried chicken took over the world or how Instagram changes the way people are actually eating. It's a food show where everyone is welcome. Come join us. You can listen to The Splendid Table wherever you get your podcasts.
Enjoy food the way nature intended. Alaska Seafood, wild, natural, and sustainable. For more information, visit wildalaskaseafood.com.
All right. And welcome. This is What Doesn't Kill You, Food Industry Insights. I'm your host, Katie Kiefer. And today we are going to be speaking with Ferd Heffner, who is the founding staff member of the National Sustainable Agriculture Coalition, and somebody whose name I see all over the place in sort of progressive food annals, shall we say. He has been a leader in the sustainable agricultural community for over 30 years. Ferd led the NSACs, that's the National Sustainable Agricultural Coalition, federal policy work from 1988 through 2016, and now serves in a mentoring and advisory role to the coalition. Prior to his work with NSAC, for nearly a decade, he represented Interfaith Action for Economic Justice and its predecessor, the Interreligious Task Force on U.S. Food Policy on Federal Farm Food and Development Policies. He has consulted with many NGOs and has served on numerous USDA advisory committees. Welcome to the program, Ferd. I'm honored to have you on the show. I really am. And I'm wondering why it's taken me so long.
Not a problem. Happy to be with you.
All right. That's great. So first of all, I think you should probably tell people about the National Sustainable Agriculture Coalition.
Yeah, we are the way that the sustainable agriculture community across the country tries to get policy reform on food and ag policy done in Washington, D.C. We're grassroots-based. We have over 125 member organizations from coast to coast that do their own thing at the state and local level and programmatically on the farm and in research and many different areas. The thing they have in common is joining together to help impact federal policy at the national level through the coalition.
Right.
And that's what we do and been doing since 1988.
So you guys are basically a lobbying organization.
Yeah, that's correct.
Yeah.
We tend to use the word advocacy, but we're happy to use the word lobbying.
I think you might as well. I mean, nobody else seems to be ashamed of lobbying. Why should you be?
This is true.
Yeah, I mean, and what's amazing to me is that, as your bio mentions, the organization is over 30 years old. And at the time, agricultural reform was hardly on the radar, at least for me. And I think probably not so much for many other Americans. What prompted you guys to fire this up 30 years ago? I mean, we weren't really thinking about these things.
Yeah, or maybe it wasn't as much in the broad public consciousness. Just autobiographically, I started in this business as a congressional intern a little over 40 years ago, and the first two assignments I had was to try to figure out how to fund and implement the National Farm to Consumer Direct Marketing Act and the Urban Gardening Act, which were mid-1970s laws that Congress passed. So, you know, there have been things going on for quite a period of time, but maybe not at the same level that we see today. But the start of NSAC was really, in large part, fashioned out of the farm crisis of the 1980s when we had record number of farm foreclosures and bankruptcies and farmer suicides and all that went with that huge depression in the agricultural economy, and farmers were desperately looking for the way forward. And, you know, the official line from many in the field was, you know, get bigger, get out,
right,
get really large so that you could get by on small volumes. And I think family farms in general and small and mid-scale family farms in particular were looking for a different approach, one that emphasized decreasing input costs and increasing the market gate potential of value-added and specialty items in agriculture, and that's really the group that put this all together. It was farmers seeking those kinds of options coming out of the farm crisis so
right.
that they could continue to have strong family farms and strong rural communities out of the ashes of that farm crisis.
Right, and here we are full circle, basically, for many small and medium, and certainly for the dairy industry. Same thing happening all over again.
Yeah, that
and
is true.
Wouldn't you say that, I mean, that was, it seems to me, and I do not have anything like the history that you have in this community, but it seems to me that the 70s was kind of the beginning of the sort of corporate expansion, the consolidation of various aspects of the agricultural industry. Am I right about that? That has sort of led us to the place that we are now? Or was that already a factor, the consolidation?
It was, at the farm level, it's basically been consolidation since the 1930s, but certainly accelerating in the 1960s quite a bit.
Yeah.
So, in terms of sort of the agribusiness side of it, there's been concentration for a long time, but we're seeing, completely exaggerated new levels of concentration at the, especially at the farm input side.
Yeah, right. You're talking about the Monsanto Bayer deal that just, I think, just got.
And the other two big deals that were similar to with Dow and DuPont and with Syngenta.
Right. Right, and ChemChina. Yeah, incredible. Let's talk for. We're going to talk about the farm bill, but what did you think when it went down? Like, I was surprised. Were you? Did you feel like the? Oh, sure. Of course, this was never going to pass muster. What did you think about
yes
that?
Yes and no. We were certainly advocating its defeat because the bill that came out of the House Ag Committee is, pretty much the worst farm bill we've ever seen. and so we were working for it to go down and urging people to go back to the drawing board. On the other hand, it's fairly rare that the leadership of the House, no matter who controls it, it's rare for the leadership to call a bill to the floor that they're not sure they have the votes for. So we had thought that in the last 24 or 36 hours before the bill came up, they must have cut some backroom deals. And so we were nervous about it, and clearly they hadn't. So they're going to possibly try again. Time will tell, but later.
Will they have made changes? Like, what were the sticking points? Remind the audience of what were the sticking points on this.
What they're going to do is just simply revote on the same exact proposal without changes, and we think that there's a reasonable likelihood they'll have the same result. What they're hoping for is that a completely different piece of legislation on immigration will have, even if they haven't agreed on it, they will have agreed on a process that will make all the various factions of the majority party happy enough with the process that they'll then decide, okay, we'll let the farm bill go forward. We're not so sure that people are ready to say that a bad farm bill should be passed, based on what happens on another piece of legislation entirely.
Right.
So
right.
We shall see.
And yet immigration is so tightly tied to the agricultural industry. I mean, without immigrants, nobody picks, nobody slaughters, nobody processes. I mean, right? Nobody milks.
Yeah.
I mean, immigrant labor is essential.
Difficult to quite fathom how the current administration, which had strong support in rural areas of the country, has managed on trade and on immigration and on ethanol to completely offend the and go counter to the interests that largely backed them in the election.
Yeah.
So it's a head scratcher.
It is a head scratcher. And you know what's even more perplexing is I interviewed the guy who started, of course I can't remember his name, Mike, I've forgotten his last name, but it was a show about 6 or 7 weeks ago with the Organization for Competitive Markets. And this guy was a Trump supporter. And I said, do you think that in light of what's been happening on trade, especially, that the farming community will continue to support the Trump administration? And he said, yes.
Okay. All right. Vote against yourself.
It's conceivable, but I don't think that's a sure thing yet, especially on the trade side.
Yeah. Well, I don't think anybody's
a lot of nervousness.
Yes. And yes, a lot of nervousness. And, you know, and if these trade deals or, you know, if the NAFTA agreement is gutted and farmers have no place, you know, can't sell to their biggest trading partners and various other things happen, you know, the economic squeeze is going to be very profound. Obviously, there'll be a lot of people going out of business and that should change their minds. Yeah. You know, there's a horrible feeling of like, okay, let the worst happen. I mean, that's how I feel personally. I'm just like, okay, great. Let him do something so egregious that we just have to completely swing the other way in a major way. That's what I'm hoping for. Anyway, let's talk a little bit more about the farm bill. So before we get there, I was hoping that you would explain why, you know, what the subsidies and crop insurance, why are some commodity crops subsidized either directly or through crop insurance, why other food crops are not subsidized? That seems very counterintuitive. Like, why would you subsidize corn and soy, but you wouldn't subsidize broccoli, for instance?
Yeah, that's a good question. And there's a kind of a long answer, but I'll try to give you the short answer. So
okay,
most of the
minutes.
Major field crops are part of the historic Farm Bill commodity titles. And, you know, those crops make up the vast majority of total cropland in the country.
That's true.
But they also share in common the fact that they're non-perishable crops that are stored and marketed over a long period of time. And that was really the focus of the commodity programs going all the way back to the New Deal.
Yeah.
How to try to bring oversupply into control so that prices didn't crash and farmers go out of business. So from basically 1933 until 1996, in a variety of ways, the purpose, the reason why we had commodity programs was to try to control excess production. And the government would pay farmers to reduce production in various mm-hmm. ways to keep prices at a steady but profitable level.
Right.
That all changed after 1996, and now you can find agricultural economists and policy people who will try to say why we have commodity programs today. But absent that supply control function, it's not entirely clear why we still have them. So that's a whole other matter. But to get back to your original question, the reason for that is those are non-perishable, stored,
right,
marketed over a long period of time crops, whereas your fruits and vegetables are perishable crops that have to be marketed immediately. So they're not, you could never have the same kind of commodity program for fruits and vegetables that you have for grains and oilseeds and cotton. So that's really the distinction. That does not mean that there aren't government programs for what we call today specialty crops. That's a term that some people like and some people don't like, but I'll usually say fruits and vegetables just to make it clear what we're talking about.
Yeah.
But there have been a whole variety of ways of government, that the government intervenes in the fruit and vegetable markets. There's marketing orders and marketing agreements and promotion programs and a whole way that crops get taken off the market and put into the food school food distribution network. All of those policies tend to improve the price or stabilize the price of fruits and vegetables. So there is government intervention. It's just not through a subsidy system. It's a different setup.
It's more of a marketing, of a marketing platform.
Right.
So money is spent on that as opposed to paying farmers directly for not overproducing. So, you know, that leads me to the question is like, why don't we have that program don't we have that program for dairy farmers, and why are we overproducing and why is dairy in the dumps?
That's another really good question. So
I did six weeks of interviews about dairy and I still don't quite get it.
in 2013, when the last farm bill and into 2014, when the last farm bill was being put together, the proposal on the table from the dairy, the dairy farmers.
Dairy Farmers of America? You mean the big lobbying group?
As organized nationally, was to both have the program we wound up with, which is a margin protection program. I won't go into the specifics, but it's a mm-hmm. payment program. And as well as a supply control program, and it was both things. And the dairy industry, as opposed to dairy farmers, opposed the supply control function. And in Congress, the then Speaker of the House, John Boehner, personally intervened to make sure that the supply control function was left out of the final bill.
Whoa.
And so we don't have that function, and therefore there's nothing to prevent surplus dairy production.
Right.
And therefore, both the payment side, it would be higher than it otherwise would be, and there's no real stabilization function.
Right. You have just explained the mystery. Really. I mean, honestly, I conducted 6 or 8 interviews with dairy farmers, with lobbyists. I did a whole dive on it. That was my whole season this year because I was just so perplexed. You know, Canada has a robust dairy industry, and meanwhile, dairy farmers in America are slitting their wrists. And I was just like, what the hell?
Well, there is that very interesting trade connection, because part of the goal of renegotiating NAFTA from the U.S. side is to try to force Canada to get rid of its dairy supply control policy so that they're in the same boat we are, and which is unfortunate if we could learn from them more than they could learn from us.
Absolutely. And yet I didn't really hear a lot of dairy farmers saying, oh, yes, I want to control my supply. I mean, you know.
No, it's become unpopular. You know, what once was for decades very popular has become mm-hmm. unpopular, in part because mega farms have gotten good at, you know, trying to squeeze profit out of a very small margin because they're producing such huge quantities.
Yeah.
And so that's begun, you know, that's sort of become the goal rather than maintaining a strong system of family farms and strong rural communities that go with that.
Right.
And so it's become, you know, we've slid towards a policy whereby maximum production of commodities is the goal as opposed to maximum
stability, right,
for family farm survival.
Interesting. I mean, just fascinating. Okay, so let's move on though, because we weren't really supposed to be talking about dairy. now I want you to explain crop insurance. So is that what you were? That's a different thing entirely from even the marketing platform that you described for fruits and vegetables, the commodity subsidy pricing for non-perishable crops. What is crop insurance seem to be taking sort of, is that the program where farmers pay in a certain amount and then they're supposed to get protection when their crops fail or something happens like a fire or something? And I'm thinking about the wildfires, for example, last year that burned up a lot of farmland in Kansas and Colorado and Texas. Is that where crop insurance kicks in?
Yeah, so we've had crop insurance in this country for a long, federal crop insurance for a very mm-hmm. long time. It's only become a really big deal in the last 15 to 20 years, and that's because before the farmer, paid the majority of the premium for the insurance, and the taxpayer kicked in a small amount, and it was yield insurance. So if you lost your crop or your crop was damaged, that's what the insurance was for. That all started to change, as particularly in the year 2000, which was the major crop insurance legislation that passed Congress and became law, and introduced the idea of revenue insurance, which also insured against price swings, and completely changed the subsidy formula so that the taxpayer paid the majority of the premium and the farmer paid the minority. So it sort of flipped who paid the mm-hmm. premium, most of the premium. And so that the goal of that was to get more farmers to take out insurance in part with the thought that commodity programs might eventually go away and we needed a replacement.
Mm-hmm.
That's not been borne out in reality, but that was openly talked about at the time.
Mm-hmm.
But with the more lucrative deal and with the ability to insure yourself against price swings as well as yield problems, it obviously became much more popular. And now you have the vast majority of farmers that do insure. By acres, most of that is the same crops as the commodity crops, since those are the majority of acres anyway. But crop insurance, unlike the commodity programs, are also open to fruits and vegetables and, to a limited extent, livestock and dairy, but that's fairly limited so far.
Yeah, interesting. Let's talk a little bit more about the platform for NSAC in terms of what the Farm Bill should include. And so you guys on your website, you say that your platform includes conservation and stewardship, and that would be things like, you know, cover crops and no-till farming techniques and things like that. Am I right?
And
That's right. I've heard from farmers and other people in the industry that a lot of times either it's impractical for them to have a cover crop in, for example, because the way the cover crop grows, like the timing is wrong for putting in your next crop. There's that problem. There's also the problem of how much it costs in terms of both actual seed and the labor and, you know, fossil fuels involved. And so I guess my question is like. Will a new farm bill address some of those financial and logistical concerns that a lot of farmers have that have maybe prevented them from advancing in those directions?
Right. And that's why we have what we call working lands conservation programs. They are relatively new. They've existed since 1996. Before that, we only had conservation programs that took land out of production and put them into conserving uses. And we still have the latter, but part of NSAC's mission over time was to create working lands conservation programs to get farmers to do things like cover crops and crop rotations and advanced nutrient and pest management activities. So we've succeeded, in part beyond our wildest dreams, such that now roughly 60% of Farm Bill conservation dollars are for working lands programs.
Oh, that's great.
And there are two basic flavors. There's a program called Environmental Quality Incentives Program, which basically shares the public shares the cost of initial adoption of conservation activities with farmers. And then there's the Conservation Stewardship Program, which encourages farmers to go sort of beyond the basic level to more advanced environmental production systems. And we support both programs, and we think they're both vitally important. The House Farm Bill that has been defeated but is going to be voted on again at the end of the month completely does away with the Conservation Stewardship Program.
No way.
And, just keeps the Environmental Quality Incentives Program, and more, just as importantly, cuts total funding for working lands programs by $5 billion over the next period of time. So that was one of our strongest points of disagreement with the House bill, not that there aren't many others.
But, Ferd, whose best interest is that? Like, who is making that kind of decision?
It is a perplexing question, because there are over 70 million acres enrolled in the Conservation Stewardship Program. It's the biggest conservation program by acres that we've ever had in the history of the country.
Uh-huh.
And it's pretty, you know, in terms, there's acres enrolled in all 50 states, and it's pretty distributed across the country. So it's really hard to see, and you know, 2 to 3 times as many farmers try to enroll each year in the program as there are acres available to be enrolled.
Whoa.
So the demand is high, the actuality is big, and big, you know, in terms of the landscape size of the program. So why would the House then try to get rid of the program? This will sound too much like a Washington, D.C. answer, but I think it's probably the true answer, which is the House Republican leadership views getting rid of this program as something that they can then trade with the Senate when the Senate eventually does its bill, which won't get rid of the program and say, okay, if you want to keep the program, then you got to give us something else.
Like what we want on immigration or something like that.
Yeah, whether that's, you know, destroying the food stamp program or, you know, giving more larger subsidies to big farms or whatever.
Oh, my God. I'm literally nauseous. In fact, Dave, let's take a quick sponsor drop while I recover myself after that answer, Fern. But we'll be right back with Fern Hafner from NSAC, National Sustainable Agriculture Coalition. We got a lot more to talk about, so stay tuned, folks. Thanks for listening.
Think about what it takes to swim a coastline longer than the entire eastern seaboard and leap tall waterfalls in a single bound. What does it take to survive 200 feet deep in icy salt water? What would you be made of? Wild Alaska Seafood is made of tight muscle mass, long chain omega-3s, and incredible micronutrients. It matters where your food comes from. Experience the flavor of the fittest in every bite and enjoy food the way nature intended. Alaska Seafood, wild, natural, and sustainable. Ask for Alaska on the menu, grocery store, or smart device. For more information, visit wildalaskaseafood.com.
This is What Doesn't Kill You, Food Industry Insights. I'm your host, Katie Kiefer, and I'm chatting today with Fern Hafner, who is the, I guess you're now the mentor and advisor for the National Sustainable Agriculture Coalition. And no doubt you're on to, you know, other worthy things. You'll have to tell us about that when you get to the point where at the end of the program, I have you promote yourself shamelessly and we'll talk about what you're doing.
Okay.
I'm still absorbing that last incredible revelation about how politics works, which I think nobody really, you know, we never really think about the horse trading that goes on somehow, or maybe it's always gone on. I know that's true. Like everybody always talks about backroom deals in politics, but it was just very discouraging. let us go on because there were lots of really interesting points about your platform, which I read. It's 126 pages long. People, I just want you to know how much I love you that I read this thing. There was my Saturday. You guys had a bit about the impact of sequestration on program funding in the Farm Bill. I had never heard of that before. And I thought it was so stramifying that it might be worth chatting about for just a second. So tell us about what does that mean? What are they doing when they sequester funding for certain programs?
Yeah, it's kind of inside baseball, but it has really powerful effects. So when they reached a budget deal back several years ago, they in order to get a deal done, they promised fiscal conservatives that should Congress be unable to reach certain levels of funding, then automatic budget cuts would occur. So it's kind of a lazy man's approach to budgeting rather than making the tough decisions yourself. You sort of put in place ahead of time an automatic process that automatically chops money out of the budget across the board. And several times since that original budget deal, when other funding mechanisms weren't working out for other pieces of legislation, they said, oh, we'll just add more years to sequestration. So now it's with us through most of the 2020s because they keep adding to it. And it impacts a wide variety across all of government, but in the Farm Bill in particular, it affects the commodity programs, which we've been talking about, but also the conservation programs and some of the smaller programs that help fruit and vegetable producers and others. And so each year, and unless and until Congress removes sequestration, Congress could say, well, this program is going to be $1 billion a year, and then sequestration comes along and cuts 6-8% out of that each year on kind of an automatic basis. And I will say that most members of Congress have long since forgotten that sequestration is happening, because they'll have debates about funding levels as if the funding levels they're talking about are the real ones. The real ones actually are minus the sequester that happens every year. So it's bad policy. It's bad government. Congress should be able to make the decisions rather than say, well, we're going to create this sort of invisible budget chopping machine that, you know, then we'll pretend we don't have any control over, oh, that's sequestration, that's not us. Well, it is them. They're the ones that decided to put it in place.
Yeah, right, right. And then you wonder also, like, I mean, is there some industry, you know, advantage to the, like, I don't know, somebody is getting something for this. It ain't farmers. That's all I know. Anyway, you had some other programs that I thought were worth talking about too. The agricultural land easement and the agricultural conservation easement programs. Why are those important? Why should we be knowing about them and supporting them?
Yeah, so, you know, easements are legal documents that allow you to preserve certain values over a long period of time. And there are two major types within the agricultural conservation easement program. There are wetland easements, which help landowners, mostly farmers, to restore wetlands where they used to be but had been drained years back. And it's actually one of the principal mechanisms we have as a nation to try to reach no net loss of wetlands. Because these restored acres, we have almost 3 million acres of them now through this program. So that's really, really important for a whole variety of reasons, biodiversity and wildlife and water
carbon sequestration,
pollution control. So they serve multiple purposes. The other ones are called agricultural land easements, and it's primarily for farmland preservation in areas of the country that have strong development pressure that could convert farms into shopping centers and housing and roads and whatnot. It also covers grasslands that, more out west in particular, where they could be at risk for conversion to, you know, ski chalets or whatever. So important to try to keep as much quality farmland and farming as we can. And so it's a program that does both of those, and they were joined together. They used to be separate programs. They were joined together in the 2014 Farm Bill, which was fine. We didn't have a problem with the consolidation, but when they consolidated them, they also cut the funding in half. And so a big thing for this Farm Bill is going to be trying to put that money back so that it's operating at more full strength. That's one of the few good things the House Farm Bill did. It did actually restore a good chunk of that money that they took away in 2014. So that was one of the positives.
Well, let's hope they retain that in the next iteration of it. So we talked a little bit about setting limits on production of certain crops and dairy to stabilize prices. Is that a place where the Farm Bill has a lot of power, or is that something that is completely separate from... You know, those kinds of regulations, that would not be in the Farm Bill, would it?
Well, it would be. Historically, it would be. But, we've basically surrendered most of those tools. In fact, about the only major tool that's left in the toolbox is the Conservation Reserve Program, which takes farmland out of production for 10 years at a time through a rental payment contract with the government. And that is a big issue for this Farm Bill. The current level of the Conservation Reserve Program is 24 million acres, and there are members who are trying to push that up closer to 30 million acres. The trouble is, you know, that's debatable one way or the other from the standpoint of conservation purposes, but from the standpoint of trying to get prices up, you know, even if they moved it to 26 or 28 million acres, it would have pretty negligible impact on prices. So you would really have to have a much larger reserve program like that to impact prices in any significant way.
Didn't we used to have, just to speak for a second about the stabilization of prices, didn't we used to have like a national granary? I remember reading a book that included information about, I think it was Eric Holt Jimenez's book, of Foodie's Guide to Capitalism. Did you read that by any chance?
No, I didn't.
Very good book. And anyway, I think it was there that he describes, like, at a certain point, you know, earlier part of the 20th century, there was, and up until quite late in the 20th century, there was something called the National Granary. And that was how they stabilized commodity prices, was that they would just have a grain reserve.
Right. There were two principal mechanisms through the second part of the 20th century. One was annual acreage reductions, called various things over various pieces of time. But basically, your government payment was contingent on removing X percent of your farm from production. And so that was annually determined by the Department of Agriculture looking at supply and demand functions. And then the other one was exactly what you say, the grain reserve function. And from 1977 through 1996, we had a farmer-owned grain reserve, slightly different than the ones from earlier decades. This was controlled by the farmer, but at price levels. There was a price level at which you could put grain into the reserve, and there was a price level at which you could take grain out of the reserve, which had the effect of moderating price swings so that they would swing within that band, but not, they wouldn't crash real low or hit really high.
Because, of course, so that has a knock-on.
It was a good, you know, strong policy from both the farmer perspective and the consumer perspective. But by the mid-1990s, the majority opinion in Congress and, you know, to some extent in the farming community was, we don't want to do that anymore. We want all-out maximum production come what may. And as a result, we're, you know, still paying $15 to $20 billion a year between commodity programs and crop insurance for the luxury of having wide price swings. I could put it that way.
Yeah, and we laugh. But I mean, honestly, this is just like, you just feel like this whole thing is just run amok. I mean, like, you know, right off the rails with no rhyme or reason to a lot of these policy maneuvers, at least to my mind. I mean, I don't even understand how this benefits even the big, you know, agri-industries so much, you know, like the Cargills or the Archer Daniel Midlands or whatever, you know, like how do these massive price swings, you know, how are they good for them? You know, they're the big grain producers. I don't really understand. I mean, they get the crop subsidies, I guess.
Yeah, I mean, there were definitely problems with the set-aside system in terms of, you know, farmers not necessarily taking their best quality land out of production, and it didn't have quite the effect that it might have otherwise, but also because if it was predictable that our set-asides would be at a certain level for a period of years, then other countries would increase their production and sort of nullify the effect. So there were problems, but you know, from the grain trade perspective, having everybody go all out just gives you more options. Your business is based on volume, not on price. So
right. Yeah. Let's talk for a minute about SNAP, just because that is a big part of the farm bill. And it doesn't look like it looks like SNAP is going to supplemental nutrition assistance programs, otherwise known as food stamps, that there will not be certainly any increase in funding. And in fact, I said this in my outline, but a couple of years ago before the election, I was sort of trolling around Congress, House of Representatives, looking for guests for my radio show. And I happened upon a young person named Thomas Massey, who was the representative, Republican representative from Kentucky. And I said something about, you know, controlling the food industry, or, you know, how do you feel about the food industry, blah, blah, blah. And he said, well, we just let the food industry do what they want. I mean, they're doing a great job of feeding people. And I said, well, wait a minute. They're not really, because there's so many, you know, 40 million food insecure people in the United States. That doesn't seem like that's really working out so well. And he was literally, I mean, he was shocked. He was shocked to the point where he was like, well, I don't want to be on your radio program. And he literally turned around and walked away from me. But the thing that really struck me was that seemed to be news to him. And as a result, I've been wondering to myself ever since, like, do these people actually know what is happening to their constituents? And what can we do to help them understand why supplemental nutrition assistance programs and WIC and all the other safety net things are so important and why they need to vote for those in the Farm Bill? I just don't understand how you can turn your back on that. What do you think the Farm Bill can do to, or how can we explain? How do we imagine to getting them to vote yes on further funding?
Yeah, you're defeated already. Yes, right now on improved benefit levels is beyond the scope of what is possible immediately. Though ultimately there do need to be benefit improvements. It's fairly meager assistance at this point. But the big question for this go round is whether or not the program will be basically kept as is with maybe a few minor tweaks. That's where the Senate is going. Or where the House is, you know, major cutbacks both through the elimination of states' abilities to allow sort of streamlined enrollment procedures that are really important for making sure that people that need to be on the rolls are on the rolls, and then the work requirement, which has been the one that's gotten the most attention.
Yeah.
There are work requirements now. This is for a very small slice of the food stamp population that's, you know, adults without
dependents.
Without young children.
Right.
It's, you know, less than 10% of the total population on food stamps, but that's where the House majority is, you know, really, really focused, and it's part of their bigger effort that they put under the heading of welfare reform, mm-hmm. where they, you know, try to make the point that here we have an economy, at least from an unemployment standpoint, that's going great guns. There shouldn't be reasons for able-bodied adults without young children to not have a job, and that's sort of their mantra, and to the point where that overrides the other mantra that they also normally have, which is not to create big new federal bureaucracies, but in the House Farm Bill, they're proposing to take the savings from these various cuts to food stamps, which are estimated to take 2 to 3 million people off the rolls, and put that money into a new state-by-state bureaucracy to do job training for SNAP recipients. So that's sort of the state of play. I think the true political fact of life is that the Senate isn't even debating these policies that are in the House Farm Bill because they know that the Farm Bill won't pass in the Senate if they did, just because of the ratios between Republicans and Democrats in the Senate. So at the end of the day, those policies aren't going to be in a final Farm Bill that clears the U.S. Senate and gets to the White House. And therefore, you know, just from a practical standpoint, the House leadership is willing to have the Farm Bill gone down to defeat several weeks ago, and potentially the same thing happens again later in June, in order to prove a point, I guess, from their standpoint about welfare reform that doesn't stand any chance of ever becoming law in this Congress.
Jesus.
So I don't know. For all the talk that they do about, we got to pass the Farm Bill because farmers need certainty,
they are
doing everything in their power to make sure that we don't get a Farm Bill and farmers don't get the certainty that
right.
they proclaim. So it's an interesting thing. And it's compounded by the fact that Speaker of the House Paul Ryan is also retiring from Congress at the end of this year. And he said in the weeks leading up to the Farm Bill defeat on the House floor that, you know, he helped get the big tax cut for wealthy Americans through the House, and the last big thing he wanted to do before he retired was to get these work requirements on SNAP. which was mind-boggling, that of all the, you know, potential goals one could have for one's last years in Congress, that that would be the number one thing. But that's what he said.
Punish the poor. So much fun. Let's talk about farm-to-fork networks, because you guys, you know, are committed to fostering more opportunity. And so, you know, in the 10 years that I've been doing this program, I have often spoken about the lack of infrastructure and the need to re-regionalize the food system. These are not original thoughts to me. These are my guests who tell me these things, and then I retain them, just as I will probably retain one or two facts from you. But, you know, I don't see anyone growing, particularly invested in growing those networks of infrastructure like processing, facilities, warehousing, aggregation, you know, centers and so forth. And I'm just wondering, like, even though we've been talking about this for 10 years, is it happening? Is that happening? Or am I missing it? Or is it still not happening? And if not, what can we do to sort of foster that as we move forward? Because clearly it's going to be on the onus will be on communities and farmers, and certainly not expecting any help from government.
Yeah. No, I think it is happening. It just needs to happen at a bigger and more accelerated pace to really have a fully functioning sort of regional food economy.
Yeah.
So, you know, so from our vantage point as federal policy wonks, for lack of a better term, you know, we think of it in terms of what can the government do that would help accelerate and sort of prove that the concept will work and is viable. So one thing that we did long time ago, relatively speaking, all the way back in 2000, was help Congress create a program called the Value-Added Producer Grant Program, kind of unique thing where the government gives grants to farmers or groups of farmers that are organizing a value-added business, so taking what they're producing on their farm and making it a consumer-ready product. And some of these some people do this on their farm, like, for instance, a dairy farmer who has their own dairy processing right on site, perhaps with a farm store or in-town store that goes with it. Is an example of that. It also applies to farmer co-ops that are where you have a group of farmers getting together to perhaps market grass-fed beef or pastured-raised hogs or whatever the case might be. Just using those as examples. So it's been around for a while. It's never had super robust funding, but we've kept it alive through multiple farm bills. The USDA's own Economic Research Service just came out with a report several weeks ago where they looked back through all the people who have gotten value-added producer grants and said, how are these businesses doing relative to small businesses in general? Mm-hmm. And their results were that those businesses that had value-added grants are doing much better, much more likely to survive, much more likely to expand over time. So we're really pleased with that.
Yeah.
It's just one of the many programs, government programs like that, that we spend a lot of time working on. Again, the House Farm Bill that got defeated completely left the Value-Added Producer Grant Program high and dry.
No way.
Not a dime of funding. We expect that to be different when the Senate does its bill, and that will be another thing that we're fighting for in conference. And there's a whole range of these local and regional food programs that are part of the Farm Bill that we hope will be preserved and expanded where possible.
And are these things that people can call up their congressional representative and say, I want you to support this in the Farm Bill?
Absolutely, absolutely. Mm-hmm. And we've put a lot of those proposals together in a bill, you know, so that they're all located in one place. We often help members of Congress put together bills that they're not bills that are going to go through committee and become law. They're bills that we put out there to say, hey, here's the kind of thing that should be in the next farm bill.
Right.
And so there is a local farms bill in both the House and the Senate that contain a lot of these ideas.
How much are these guys reading this stuff, do you think? Is it all just their staff? And then their staff says, okay, this looks good, this looks bad.
There's certainly a heavy staff function, and that's important for constituents to know because the best grassroots lobbyists are the ones that can develop relationships with those key staff people mm-hmm. over time. It's fine at the broader level to, you know, sort of click on things on websites or to put in the occasional call to the receptionist. And those are worth something, but the grassroots calls that are really worth a lot are the ones that are actually going to staff people who over time learn who you are because you bother them from time to time.
Right, politely.
Yes, indeed.
All right, Ferd, we have reached the moment in this program where you promote yourself shamelessly, your organization, and whatever else you want to talk about, like, people should learn more about National Sustainable Agriculture Coalition at website.
Yeah.
Say website.
Yes. So, for sure, National Sustainable Agriculture Coalition, I think, is an organization people should know about. The website is sustainableagriculture.net. We have lots of good information on there, including things of how to take action at the grassroots level with members of Congress. A lot of great publications. We have one that's a grassroots guide to federal farm and food programs where you can get sort of quick, easy-to-read information about a whole variety of federal programs that could be a benefit. We have some guides that are very specific to certain programs. They're all on our publications page on the website. So I'd call people's attention to that. And if people out there listening are part of an organization, a farmer organization or a food or conservation organization, and interested in federal policy reform but not yet a member of the National Sustainable Agriculture Coalition, I'd encourage people to get in touch with our grassroots people here on staff, and they'd be happy to talk to you about membership. So,
fantastic. I'm ready to sign up, even though I don't have a farm. Cool. Thank you so much for having. And what are you doing before I let you go? What are you doing now that you're no longer actually on the day-to-day running the organization? Do you have a brand new role that you want to talk about?
Yeah, I'm now the senior advisor. It's like you mentioned before, some mentoring and training, but also sort of filling in some gaps here and there. I'm also, because the last 30 years has not given me a moment to think about, recording or archiving the history of all this policy change, I'm going to spend some time doing that, too, before I bow out of the scene. So and some special projects, one of which is helping a dialogue between USDA leadership and very small meat processing plants around the country who are trying to really engage the pasture-raised and grass-fed markets. So it's fun to be able to have some time to do projects that otherwise I wouldn't have had time to do before.
Yeah. So you must have gone to Greg Gunthorpe's farm in Indiana, right?
I have indeed.
I love that guy. He's like, keep trying to get him on the show because I think he's such an example. He's such an amazing dude. But anyway, maybe next
Greg's
year.
Greg's terrific.
He's terrific. Thank you so much for joining me today. This has been a wonderful conversation. I look forward to having you on again. I hope you'll join me in the fall when I come back from my little summer break. And my thanks to Alaska Seafood for sponsoring this show and for supporting the Heritage Radio Network, and of course to the wonderful engineer and light of my life, Dave Tatasciore. Thanks for listening, folks. We'll see you sometime soon. Take care.
Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to hear about exclusive events, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at heritage_radio. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Rate the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join our community by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.
Hey everybody, I'm Nick Layton.
And I'm Leah Bonema.
And we're the hosts of Were You Raised by Wolves?
Each week we try to make the world a kinder, nicer place.
Well, that's the idea at least.
I mean, we try.
Have you ever wondered what to do if you're ghosted?
Or what to do when a friend asks you to borrow money?
Or the proper way to eat Cheetos?
You know, the big questions.
So please find Were You Raised by Wolves wherever you listen.